Welcome to A Life Lived. I'm Stephanie Okupniak. This is part two of our tribute to Alan Rickman. If you haven't heard part one, I recommend you go back and have a listen. You'll find out how an artist from West London marched into Hollywood to become the conqueror of Nakatomi Tower. Alan worked hard to achieve his success, and it couldn't have happened at a better time. He loved acting, but he was stuck in a spiral. I mean, we can all relate to a vocational spiral. Now that Alan had made it, he always stayed true to his roots. The friendships he made meant the world to him and never wanted to make them feel left behind. Alan's friend, collaborator, and mentee, actress Juliet Stevenson, saw this firsthand.
What was wonderful for Alan was that he got famous and successful. I mean, I think I don't know anybody who needed that more than he did. And it eluded him for a long time. You know, that season at Stratford when we did As You Like It, and she was Jaques and I did Rosalind, and then we did Lilies and Roserose, and we also did an amazing, beautiful production of Troilus and Cressida. I was doing Cressida and he was doing Achilles. We did every show together in that season, and then we took all the shows to London for the following year. And he was brilliant in all those three plays, in those three roles, but he got no recognition for any of them. He didn't get brilliantly reviewed, and he got into a huge depression until Les Liaisons. Sorry, that was the third show of the season. And then the last show of the season to open was Les Liaisons Dangereuses, in which he was playing the lead as Valmont, and I was doing Lindsay Duncan was Madame de Meurthe, and I was doing Madame de Tourvel, the young woman who gets seduced by him. And it overnight was a smash hit. So suddenly he went from having a very troubled period where he was not particularly well received, and he was probably 40 by then, and thinking, you know, what's happening to my career? And then suddenly this unexpected overnight smash hit in the studio space at Stratford, went to London, went to the West End, went to New York, Broadway, and the rest is history. So he snapped success in the way that men can in their middle years. And then, of course, you know, he didn't look back. And I think for Alan, you know, many people are spoiled by success. I think really it often trashes people. You know, you love someone and they get successful and you meet them again and you think, oh God, you're not the same person. You're full of shit. What a shame. But not Alan. He didn't forfeit a single friendship. Many of his friends were not successful people, actually, in terms of the world or careers. He never, ever let them down. He remained completely loyal to his friendships, regardless of people's status. That's rare. He enjoyed having the wealth and the power and the status, but he used it well. He used it so well. He was ridiculously generous. I mean, it was impossible to pay for anything in his presence. I never ate out in a restaurant that he didn't pay for everybody's meal. Even if you tried to get to the till halfway through the meal to pay for it, he'd already would have paid for it at the beginning. He'd have made an arrangement with the maitre d' or something. You know, he was insanely generous with money.
Alan wanted to do it all. He performed in musicals. His comedic timing was brilliant. He let his imagination run wild in science fiction roles and fantasy. But if you ever asked him what his favorite role was, he always liked to keep you guessing. Alan's brother David had a few theories.
Well, he had three. Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, obviously.
Locksley! I'm going to cut your heart out with a spoon!
I think it's got to have been the Sheriff of Nottingham. I mean, has anybody ever had more fun on a screen than Alan had playing the Sheriff of Nottingham? He was so funny. I mean, he's one of the funniest people I knew. I mean, I would roll around on the floor, weeing and crying with laughter. He made me laugh so much. And he was so funny. And he had such a delicious sense of humor. And you can see all that in The Sheriff of Nottingham. And in a way, it was such a release for him. You know, he did take himself very seriously. Sometimes people got fed up with him taking himself seriously. But he did. And we weren't allowed to. You know, that would be one note he would give me. Stop taking those photos. Okay. But you couldn't possibly give that note to him. But in the Sheriff of Nottingham, I think you see him so released. He's not having to be Alan, the sex pot, the sex symbol, Alan, the eminence grise, the wise. You know, nothing. All that self-consciousness is lifted off him, and he's just able to have the campest ride. And he loves camp. I mean, you know, there was a streak in him, and he was probably a bit nervous of it, but it was so glorious to see. And, you know, Ruby rewrote a lot of his dialogue for him. He'd invested so much in Ruby Wax, and, you know, been such a supporter and a, you know, he cracked a whip and made her write, made her, you know, he'd been at her back, pushing her on, pushing her forward as a writer, as a TV personality, as a, you know, he was always her great mentor. And I think, you know, she repaid him on that movie by giving him the most wonderful lines. And he just changed the dialogue he had, and he had much the best dialogue, so much better than Kevin Costner. And, you know, rumor had it, Kevin Costner was not happy with Alan. Very unhappy at being upstaged by Alan Rickman. Hooray!
You, my room, 10:30 tonight. You, 10:45. Bring a friend.
Rasputin? I mean, he won major awards in that for that film. And the one he had most fun with, apparently, was Galaxy Quest. It was fun from start to finish, apparently.
Shall be avenged.
Yeah. Alan was very private. You know, he'd never tell you stories about what went on set.
But if you asked Alan point blank in person, he would tell you his favorite role to play was the next one. However, being Professor Snape gave Alan an opportunity few actors ever get. Over a decade to grow a character, be internationally loved, and work with a maturing cast building bonds and friendships along the way, just like he did in his early days with the Royal Shakespeare Company.
There will be no foolish wand waving or silly incantations in this class.
Snape would have to be very much up there. He moaned a lot about Harry Potter. You know, oh God, here we go, film number 5 or something. And you think, yeah, okay, but, you know, very lovely for the bank balance. And come on, you know, you're in 7 movies of a smash hit, each one guaranteed to be a smash hit commercially and critically. Come on, you know, do not complain. The entire acting profession is busting its guts to get a small role in Harry Potter. And you've got this lead in 7 movies. And also, you know, he became good friends with J.K. Rowling, and I think he was immensely proud of being the only person, and this was when Harry Potter was like, I mean, you know, people were queuing for weeks on end all night to get the first, you know, it was like insane. I mean, there's never been an equivalent in terms of hype. I mean, so he was, you know, he and J.K. Rowling were the only two people in the entire world who knew how the story was going to end. Yeah, I think he was very proud of that. And he loved the kids. I mean, he was very, you know, he must have been wonderful to be around for those kids playing Harry and, you know, for Rupert Grint and Emma Watson and Daniel Radcliffe. Amazing to have Alan like a dad on the set, looking after them, making jokes with them, you know, basically like a godfather all the way through from however old they were when they made film number 1 to adulthood. Yeah, he loved that.
Alan's younger brother, Michael, knew how much it meant to him to nurture young talent.
I think he actually thought he was very lucky to have had the success he did, and was very aware of a lot of the people who didn't have that success. And then when he saw talent in any direction, he was very keen and wanted to help promote it, so that they didn't fall by the wayside. He was someone that, even at his funeral, was regarded as a leader. And that was mentioned several times in the actors' church. They looked to him for a lead and wisdom and thoughtfulness and lots of things like that.
I mean, one of his crowning glories was his capacity to spot talent in young people and to give it opportunity and to foster it and to put it together in the right, I mean, to put it together with the right influences. So he'd see a very talented young, I don't know, painter, and he might put them together with an interesting furniture maker so they could work together, or a great young writer would put together with an interesting director or an actor with a script, or, you know, he had a really strong producer element of putting the right ingredients together. Or, you know, when his friends like us started having children, which of course he never had, he would suggest opportunities for those children. So Ruby Wax had 3 children, and 2 of whom he said, you absolutely must go to clown school in Paris. You've got to go to the Lecoq School of Clowning and, you know, physical theatre in Paris, and that's what you need to do. And so they did. They wouldn't have done it probably without Alan. And now they have incredible, you know, they have this incredible life as comic performers. And, you know, he was brilliant at seeing young lives and young talent and putting his energies into furthering their opportunities and helping them, to guiding them towards their life choices. So those were all natural instincts in him, I think.
His mentorship was always from a place of caring and experience. But sometimes, it could be a bit much.
I sometimes got really fed up. I sometimes got really angry if he'd come and see a show, which I thought was going rather well, and he'd give me 95 notes after it, and I'd sit there in some restaurant eating a bowl of pasta while he gave me my 86th note. And I'd think, oh, God, you know, I'm 43 now. Can you just stop bloody doing this or something? I mean, there were moments when I got fed up, and also because I couldn't give them back to him. I couldn't. It wasn't equal. But, you know, I cared about that for a few years, and then I just thought, oh, God, I don't care. I don't care. I'm just grateful for the notes. They're great notes. It doesn't have to be equal. I sort of grew out of it. But there were times, you know, there were times when obviously we irritated each other. I think I irritated him quite a lot. But then I would irritate myself quite a lot if I knew myself.
But Alan's leadership, his persistence and his persuasiveness worked in his favor when he started organizing demonstrations.
We were so much a group. We were such a strong sense of tribe. I mean, we were a tribe. It was him and me and Rima and Paolo Gianizzotti and Ruby Wax and various other people in our friendship circle, very much bound up. And I was right at the bottom end. I was the young end. I was a sort of baby, you know, of the litter, as it were. But very bound up with the politics of the time. You know, we'd all go down to Greenham Common and cut the wire on the fence. You're probably too young to remember that, but it was a huge military camp, which where the Americans had kept nuclear missiles on British territory in the home counties. It's called Greenham Common. It was an RAF base with all these nuclear missiles on it, and there was a huge anti-nuclear campaign that focused on that place, and women went down there and lived down there and built tents and homes around the base, and it became a huge focus for the peace movement, the anti-nuclear movement, and we were all involved in that. We used to go down every Sunday, take a picnic, and cutting the wire was sort of the act of protest. You just could cut the wire around the fence and stick flowers in it. You know, we were on CND marches together. He was always connected to politics. But then he had naturally, you know, that time, his generation, you know, left-wing politics had been a huge thing anyway. I mean, there was CND, there was the miners' strike of 1984. You know, it was a time when you could identify as a socialist and it was a valid political identity. I mean, in my view, it still is. But anyway, his generation had been very involved in, I suppose he might even have been old enough to be involved in the end of the anti-Vietnam movement and so on. So I think it was partly generational, but it was definitely partly his instincts coming from a working class family who probably had always voted Labour, I imagine, in those days. And Alan was always wonderfully political, and we always completely saw eye to eye on politics. And he was always engaged and active. And of course, Rima, his partner, was a very active member of the Labour Party and a Labour councillor for her London borough for a long time. She was, you know, she was extremely actively engaged in Labour Party politics at that time, and for about 20 years. So we had that in common. I think we felt we had a huge passion for a certain kind of theatre in common and certain value system we shared about. We spent a lot of time trying to create an ensemble to work together in London and to get hold of various, but the Coronet Cinema we wanted to get hold of as a North London art, a West London arts sort of forum art centre, and get it sponsored and be running it ourselves. But that fell through. We tried to get hold of Hammersmith Riverside Studios and run that as an ensemble. You know, there were these various, we were bought out by the guy who bought us in the end. But yeah, we had a huge overlap in terms of value systems about the world and politics and theatre and arts and the role of the artist, I think, if that doesn't sound pretentious. And the thing is, if it sounds pretentious now, it wasn't then. I think that the sense of the artist as being the entitled to give voice to the social, moral, political issues of the day is something that was sort of taken for granted then. It's something you have to fight for now and justify and get attacked for frequently on social media. But then I think there was a consensus that there's always been a history of people working in the arts speaking out or making pieces of work around a certain issue or a theme. I mean, that's always been the case, you know, whether it's poetry, literature, painting, music, whatever. And I think we were very aligned there as well.
He was a staunch Labour supporter, and he spoke at Labour meetings and what have you.
I was with Alan when he wasn't very well in hospital, and I hadn't told him that I'd become a counsellor for Market Harborough. So I said, well, I suppose you've heard I'm a counsellor. And he said, yes, for the wrong party, because I joined the Conservatives. And I said, well, I don't think when you're actually a councillor for a rural area, it's the same as being part of the government. Really, we have to handle what's handed down by the government and make the best of it for our residents in the rural area. And he said, yes, I understand that.
Alan's activism wasn't just against the establishment. He supported multiple charities with the understanding that he would remain anonymous.
He was vice chair of RADA, and he promoted Children on the Edge. And there was something called SAFE, which was something to do with Africa. And the other thing he was big on was, the Children on the Edge was based in Romania. And he was a big supporter of that. They were children who had no promise in life. And he actually went out there once and stayed for a week sleeping in a cot.
A lot of his charity work really was done without asking for any plaudits or anything like that. He did it because it needed doing and he saw the need.
Alan enjoyed watching Wimbledon every year, but even his celebrity status didn't keep him from being starstruck.
I was involved in Wimbledon with stringing rackets and things like that because I did all the rackets for Borg, McEnroe, Connors, Edberg, Navratilova, or loads of different people like that. And so I managed to get him in the car one day to actually go to Wimbledon. And he didn't get a very good reception from the lady who was in charge of it when he arrived. And he told me, and he said, one day I will be back. And of course, later, he did go, and he was, when he became famous, he was invited to sit in the Royal Box. So he phoned me up from the Royal Box, and he said, I'm just phoning you to tell you I'm sitting in the Royal Box watching Wimbledon. I said, thank you for that. And later he told me that Borg came up to him and said how much he enjoyed watching his films. And so I said, well, didn't you say to him that your brother strung his rackets when he won all the Wimbledons? And he said, oh, no, I was too starstruck. So he did love his tennis.
He loved watching all kinds of sports, and occasionally he'd be up for a twirl.
We watched show jumping, skating, and things like Strictly he liked. He was in a video with Charlene Spiteri, and he was dancing with Charlene in that video.
No one would be able to resist those deep brown eyes and the firm embrace of the tango. But for now, I'll take the lead and guide us into the break so we can hear from the sponsors that make this podcast possible. But when we come back, we'll find out how Alan liked to unwind and what temptations he just couldn't resist. When Alan wasn't mentoring a young actor, visiting an orphanage abroad, casting spells across our screen, or speaking out at a labor meeting, he would unwind watching his friends in theater productions, indulging his sweet tooth, and relaxing in front of the telly.
Watching rubbish TV, Scrappy Challenge, Gogglebox, but he also loved going to the theater to see other people. He'd go anywhere to see his clique, if you like. I think that's the best way to describe his band of merry girls or whatever. And eating out, he loved to go to a decent restaurant. I mean, we went with him many times to eat out. And, you know, it could be fish one night. We'd go to Sheiky's. When they moved to Westfall Grove, just around the corner, there was a sort of a Mediterranean restaurant. I think he liked all sorts of food. You know, there was nothing specific, except he had a very, very sweet tooth. Oh, my God. If there was sort of half a dozen of us going for a meal, and say everybody had a pudding, he would have to dip his spoon into everybody's to taste what it was like. I'd never known anybody have a sweet tooth like that.
Rima and Alan would take some time for themselves and go on adventures around the world.
He loved to go to different places. I mean, he had the place, he bought a place in Italy, in Tuscany, a small village. And he loved to go there, because he could unwind there, and nobody really knew who he was. They got to know who he was, but he could go there. I know he went to, oh God, he went to Argentina, one holiday. He went to so many different places, him and Rima. That was one of his favourite things to do when he wasn't acting, was travelling. I mean, you know, if we went down to his place after he'd come back from somewhere or other, out would come the photos, loads and loads of photos, wherever they went. So that was a relaxation for him. I think he just wanted to see other parts of the world, probably. How the other half lived, sort of thing, maybe.
Nothing was more important to Alan than his family.
He was a big, big, big family person. He would do anything for the family.
He protected his family a lot. He didn't talk about his family very much. It wasn't that he kept them out of what he was doing or anything. And we would try to get everyone together at Christmas. When my mother was alive, I brought her up here because she had emphysema and was on oxygen 24 hours a day. And we needed to get her to countryside air so that it was a little bit better. And so every Christmas there would be sort of 14 round the table, and anyone that wanted to come, it was open house. And I think that meant a lot to him in some respects, you know, that, you know, suddenly the family was the family again. So, yeah, he was an individual, and I think he was regarded as someone special by a lot of people.
Nothing gave Alan more pleasure than supporting his family and giving them a little luxury now and then.
People the motive things for Mum, and her two sisters, Eileen, Elsie, and Doris. You know, the mobile scooter things, the motorised sit-on. He bought one for each of three of them. And he went out one day with Mum, and she was going around the shop smashing everything. And he said, "You're not driving this anymore. I'm not allowing you out anymore with this. You're too dangerous." So she never rode it again. She was lethal. But my aunt, Elsie, and Doris, they both used it continually. But if they went out shopping or what have you, they had no problem with it. But Mum was a different kettle of fish. And there was one occasion where he paid for a cruise for Mum and a friend of hers to go on as well. When he was in on Broadway back in, 2003, Private Lives, he paid, or he made sure he had a big enough apartment, and he paid for Christine and me and Sister Sheila and her husband to go out there and stay with them for a week. So we had a week in New York with him.
Alan could be in a room full of flashbulbs, paparazzi, and celebrities, and he would be completely unfazed. And by that evening, he would be doing the dishes after dinner with his family.
He was an organizer. I mean, to us, he was just natural. You know, there was no pretense about him. I mean, one of the things he loved to do was have us go down and help with the cooking, do the cooking. You know, we went down there for lunch. That's the sort of, you know, he came down to our level. I know it sounds horrible, but he was up a different level. You know, he mixed with different people. I mean, he used to go do poetry readings and things for Prince Charles, for goodness sake. But when we were together, he was just one of us.
When Alan was working on a project, that was his entire focus. He never wanted to become the center of attention, even when he fell ill.
His last film, when he was not very well anyway, which he managed to do, was Eye in the Sky. So that was his last film. But I don't think he was in full health when he actually made it. I think he wasn't, but he never complained, really. Never complained.
No one knew he was sick. Not even his closest friends knew.
I don't know why, because I wasn't privy to why, I don't think. We went round for Sunday lunch, Hugh and my husband and I, and opened the door, and he looked very altered, and he looked very thin, and he was not thin ever. So I said, "My God, darling, you've lost a lot of weight. What's happening? Is it good? I think it's good, but are you okay?" And he said, "Well, Jules, I've got to tell you, I've had a stroke." Well, I was on the floor. I just was so shocked. I said, "Why didn't you tell me you'd have a stroke? Jeez." I didn't know. We had the whole of this lunch where he was very quiet, much quieter than usual, and took a back seat all through lunch. And there were about eight of us around the table, I suppose. And going home, I said to Hugh, "I'm so shocked. I just can't cope with this." You know, what I didn't know, and he didn't even tell me then, was that the stroke was a reaction to chemo. They had given him a very, very strong, the last resort chemo, which was very, very strong, and his body had reacted to that, and that's why he'd had the stroke. But he didn't tell me that. He just told me the stroke was bad enough. I think he didn't. I think they didn't tell people, and they really didn't tell anybody. It may have partly been, which many actors don't want it known, because they don't want their careers to suffer. They don't want it out in the industry that they're that ill, in case the work just dries up, which of course it would do probably. So it's quite pragmatic. I think with him, it was probably he wanted to spare people. He just didn't want to have to cope. He had such a huge friendship group. I mean, he had his inner circle, a slot, I suppose, but then there was a circle around that, and then a circle around that, and a circle around that. I mean, he had such a huge friendship community that I think he would have been overwhelmed. Everybody would have been ringing, writing, you know, texting, emailing, sending him things, arriving at the door. I mean, because he was owed so much love and kindness and generosity from people, they would have wanted to give it back in his moment of frailty and fear. And I think he maybe just didn't want any of that. Maybe for our sake. I mean, I think I remember him saying, I think it was really for our sake, he didn't want people to be sort of in a frenzy of worry. And I think he probably didn't want to have to deal with all that. There would have been so much for him to deal with, other people's grief and anxiety and worry. I think he probably just thought, in his characteristic wisdom, I need to conserve my energies here for getting better. And if I tell the world, then masses of energy will go into making sure other people are okay. I would think that would be somewhere at play, but I'm guessing. I don't really have the right to guess, but I would think, knowing him, that's what it was. Yeah. So we, I mean, it was a big shock because he only really told us about less than 2 weeks before he died. I mean, we had only just over a week before he died that we knew. And so from the moment we knew, we were there, you know, sort of, which he wanted by then. He knew he was dying by then. It was imminent. And so then he opened his hospital room doors to his close friends. And we had this amazing time. I mean, he was astonishing. I mean, I don't know anybody who died with as much imagination, dignity. I mean, he lay in that bed, and he was in a private hospital because he couldn't really be in an NHS hospital, although he was a fantastic supporter of the NHS and passionately believed in it, but he couldn't himself be on a ward because he was too well known, I suppose. So he was in this private hospital, and we just sort of turned it into this, like, this lovely space with, you know, lamps and sofas and rugs and food and wine and fruit and music, and people would just sit telling stories, and he would just lie there and he'd say, just talk amongst yourselves, I'll come in and out. You know, he would literally come in and out. He was on morphine, and we'd chat away, and then he'd wake up for a bit, join in, and then he'd drift off again. And I think when he died, you know, that there was the tribe, you know, in that hospital room, coming and going, doing shifts, bringing in music, furnishings, a lamp, a rug, some oysters, a book, you know, we kept that sense of old family coming into that room, and while he died and giving him the best possible last few days was incredibly moving. And we'd all gone our different ways, and some people I hadn't seen for ages, you know, like Suzanne Burtish, Jane Burtish, these great, great friends of Alan's, but absolutely feel bonded, and I still do, actually. And some, and when he died, I think we were just so shattered, because he was the centre of that group. I did pluck up the courage to ask him if he was frightened of dying, because I thought he would be. I thought, I think I need to ask this question, you know. And he said, no, not really. No, I mean, it's me, it's my turn now, but it'll be your turn at some point, everybody's turn at some point, you know. This is my turn. Which was astonishing. Astonishing. Whether it was what he really felt, I don't know, but that's what he said. Very calm. I never saw a moment's fear in him, which is extraordinary because he was only 69. Yeah, he could have expected to live another 20 years at least. Yeah. And of course, as so often, he was right. He was right to leave it late. It was intense and amazing week. I've never known a week like it. If it had gone on for 3 months, it wouldn't have been the same. It wouldn't have been that intensely joyful, extraordinary experience. He reserved it. He timed it. Trust him. He timed it brilliantly. So typical.
Alan Rickman died from cancer on January 14th, 2016.
When he died, I think we were just so shattered, because he was the center of that group. He was the sort of leader of the tribe, really. And we just didn't know what to do when he died. We just really didn't know. It was like finding yourself in a car and none of you can drive, and the driver's jumped out and the vehicle's still rolling along and nobody knows how to drive it. I mean, that's a bit dramatic, but it did feel like that at first. And we just couldn't conceive of life without him. I mean, I've lost my brother, I've lost my dad, I've lost lots of people who I love dearly. And I mourn them hugely. But no death, I think, left me quite so confused or shocked in terms of this person cannot die. It's just not possible that he's dead. I just, A, he was going to live forever. B, he was certainly going to outlive me. He didn't deserve this, and nobody deserves it. But you know what I mean? It's all this sort of irrational. And then also, how am I going to? He's irreplaceable. That's what it is. I mean, everybody's irreplaceable. But there is no way. There's no human being anywhere in the world remotely like him. I'm sure there are many sort of people roughly like me running around the world in various forms, but I don't think there are any clones. I'm talking crudely because nobody has a clone and everybody's unique. But you know what I mean? He was just such an unusual person. And his role in our industry as somebody who, visionary, this amazing foster father, foster parent to talent, and you know, I don't know anybody who's like that. I mean, he really was unique in that regard.
He did organise his own funeral, I have to say. He sort of said what he wanted. He told the chap who organised it about what was to happen, what song was going to be sung, what video was going to be seen.
But then he appointed a group of us to meet after he died to discuss and create his funeral, and he cast us all in our roles. I mean, it was hilarious when you think about it. He chose what each of us, who would be the people who would perform at his memorial service, and not what we would do, but well, yeah, he chose Ian Rickson. He said, you're going to direct it, and I want Juliet to speak, and I want so-and-so to read, and I want Ian McKellen to perform this, and I want even after he died, he was still directing us, even at his own memorial service. I mean, he's got to laugh.
It was lovely, really, because there were some wonderful people who actually spoke. Sir Ian McKellen, Joanne Rowling, you know, lots of different people there. It was lovely. It was lovely, but it was difficult. He met Juliet and Ruby Wax, of course, at the Royal Shakespeare Company. And I think at his funeral, which was probably the worst day of my life, because it was non-stop, right from the beginning of the day, right through to the end of the day. And they told a story about a production that they were in and literally had the whole audience in fits of laughter. It was a difficult day because obviously I don't think I've ever cried so much. But I wrote a poem, and part of that poem was actually read at the funeral when we had the family funeral in the morning. We are but ripples on a pond. When the pond is calm, the ripples are gone. Such is life. Some people are ripples, others tidal waves, that sweep over us, envelop and guide our lives. These are the ones that shape our thoughts and destiny, open our minds and eyes to things not thought of, so we see the world differently and clearer. Impossible becomes possible. Clouds of doubt are blown away. Negative becomes positive, and we dare to dream and become we're ripples again. Alan was a tidal wave.
I mean, he was loved by all. I don't know of anybody who did not like him. People might have been a bit jealous of him, but he was loved by all. And people used to go to him with problems, and he'd try and solve them for them. He was always looking after other people rather than himself.
When he died, I thought, who is going to do what you do? Who is going to do now what you do? Which is to be this amazing mentor figure for the younger generation, to nurture talent as writers, actors, music directors, clowns, comedians. Who is going to be looking around the industry and helping the young generation and being there for them and always having an open door for them and supporting them and enabling them? Who's going to do that job? And I had never really done a lot of that because I was a lot younger and I didn't think I sort of was probably ready for that. But after he died, I thought, right, I'm gonna take on that as much as I can in your name. In your name, I'm gonna do as much of that as I can. I will pointedly mentor young actors. I will pointedly, you know, I will take that cloak of yours, as you know, that mentor cloak, and I will wear it. And I have done much. I mean, I'm not saying I can replace him, but I have consciously picked that up from him. And it's time consuming and energy consuming, but it's so rich, it's so rewarding, and it's actually, it's a lifesaver, because of course you realize how much you get back from it. I am so grateful for those young people in my life, because of course they do keep you, like kids do, they keep you oxygenated and informed and in touch with what's happening, and you know, and their optimism, their energy, and their innocence, and their ideas, and their passion, and are all so glorious to have in your life. So I think I would have, you know, I was always very busy with charities and refugees and all sorts of things. I was out in the world, but I think that particular legacy I consciously picked up from him. As in terms of the world, I think he is, you know, if people are forgotten when they die, then I think he is the least forgotten person. I mean, he lives on so vividly in people's imaginations. I think what he left behind him were lasting legacies of gifts that he gave to people. But I think in terms of the industry, I don't know, well, I would hope it would be a generosity of spirit and a cross-fertilizing of disciplines and a embracing of the young and the new. I hope that would be his legacy.
I'm not sure the words are there to describe him, really. A very caring, thoughtful, intelligent individual. Very sort of separate from a lot of other people. And someone who, when you watch his films, you'll wish you had actually had the chance to meet him.
Next, on A Life Lived.
That was a life-changing event for her. She was asked to go visit the troops in Korea, and she did. And she tells stories about seeing the wounded people and visiting them and them saying, please take me home, and how not only hurtful, but, you know, how moving all of that was to her. It influenced her forever. She always did things for the veterans because of that. And it also, though, changed the way that she approached causes when she saw that. It just meant that every cause somehow was important, and somehow she was going to find time to deal with all of them.
She was a household name by the age of 19 and a Hollywood scandal by the age of 27. But through it all, Debbie Reynolds found true happiness by giving back any way she could. We spoke with Debbie's son, Todd Fisher, about how America's original sweetheart captivated our screens and changed Hollywood glamour forever. This is an Audio Boom original production by Muddy Knees Media and Breaking Stereotypes. This podcast was presented and executive produced by me, Stephanie Okupniak. Our series editor has been Lucy Oliva. If there is an icon that you would like to know more about, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram using the handle @alifelived_.